From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Even though he had promised a new direction, most political observers didn't think Barack Obama would ditch all of George Bush's tactics for fighting the war on terror when he became president. But no one, it seems, expected him to be this aggressive. Mr. Obama has accelerated drone strikes. He's reserved the power to render suspects to other countries. He's continued military detentions for terrorists and military tribunals for trying them. Today in the program, we're talking about the evolution of the president from idealist to pragmatist. Daniel Kleidman is our guest. He's written a book that takes a behind-the-scenes look at how critical national security decisions are made and how they've raised questions about the balance between liberty and security. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. During the 2008 presidential election, Barack Obama had promised a new direction in the way the country waged the war against terrorism. He said he would close Guantanamo Bay, for example, and that he would try terrorists in civilian courts. Now, most people, even the most strident civil libertarians, figured that idealism would have to make some concessions to the reality in a fight like this. But there weren't many who expected the president to evolve quite like he has and quite so quickly. The Obama administration has ramped up the number of secret drone strikes and covert operations. The president has reserved the power to render suspects to other countries. He's continued military detentions for terrorists and military tribunals for trying them. Today in the program, we're talking about the evolution of the president from idealist to pragmatist. Daniel Kleidman is our guest. He's written a book that takes a behind-the-scenes look at how critical national security decisions are made and how they raise questions about the balance between liberty and security. The book is called Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. We invite you to join the conversation, if you like, with comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook or on Twitter. Daniel Kleidman is a special correspondent for Newsweek magazine and The Daily Beast. He's also worked as Newsweek's managing editor, its Washington bureau chief, and a Middle East correspondent as well. And he's joining us today from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Daniel Kleidman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I wanted to begin with a story that you tell in the book, because I think it's a story that illustrates kind of where you're going with the book itself and the ideas here. This is the first targeted killing under Mr. Obama's watch, and it happens, I don't know, this has seemed really surprising, just 3 days after he becomes president. Tell the story, if you would. Set this up for us.
Well, this is January 23rd, so it is literally 3 days after he becomes president, his top terrorism advisor, John Brennan, comes to him in the Oval Office and says, "Mr. President, there's been the first drone strikes of your presidency have been launched, and there's been an accident. Tribal elder in South Waziristan, who was a member of a peace committee, who was a pro-government figure there, had been killed along with much of his family." And President Obama, understandably, is quite disturbed. He's been hearing for a long time about the sort of laser-like precision of these weapons, of drones, and has already embraced the idea of using drones. The drone program continued from the previous administration. President Obama did not specifically sign off on this attack, but it was happening on his presidency. Yeah. And so he calls in the CIA leadership the next day to explain to him what happened here. And they begin to tell him about this concept called signature strikes. There's a distinction between signature strikes, which is when they don't necessarily know the identity of the group of people that they're going after, and high-value or high personality strikes when they have some sort of positive ID. He's trying to wrap his mind around this. You have to imagine this is a president who, when he came into office, as you had pointed out in your introduction, had promised to restore constitutional values to the war on terror, to take it in a different direction, but also had promised to change the message to the Muslim world. Mm. We as a country were not in very good standing with much of the world, and the Muslim world in particular, because of the perception that the war on terror was in some sense a war on Islam. And this was a president who made the decision, for example, to use his Arabic middle name, Hussein, when he was inaugurated. Mm. And yet here he is 3 days into office presiding over the death of innocent Muslims. So it was a very kind of shocking experience for him, and he began to learn about that disjuncture between the idealism of campaigning and the reality of governing and reality of governing during wartime, which can be very messy.
You report that the CIA's deputy director, Steve, is it Capps?
Kappas.
He says to the president in that meeting you mentioned where he's getting everyone together to figure out what had happened. And Kappas says to the president, he says, look, there are a lot of military age males down there. And these are men that are associated with terrorist activity. And he says, but we don't always know who they are. And the president, his response is really interesting. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, this is the concept of signature strikes, and he is trying to wrap his mind around it. The idea that we would be targeting people whose identities we don't know, you know, I think he thought that this was this drone program was extremely targeted, lethal but very targeted, and it was a way of going after people whose identity we did know, and so that there was much less of a risk of killing civilians. So he had to try to understand that. He snapped at him, essentially. He said, well, that's not good enough for me.
Yeah.
Over time, it became good enough for him.
Yeah.
I think he understood why the CIA wanted to continue this program, why they believed that in Pakistan, where in their view anyway, they had the benefit of 8 years now of human intelligence, knowing every inch of the territory, that there was less of a risk of killing civilians in Pakistan than perhaps in other places. That's debatable.
Yeah.
Civilians continue to be killed under this program. But the president did another thing at this particular moment that was important and instructive. He said, okay, I'm going to let the CIA continue this program. I'll let the CIA continue these signature strikes in Pakistan. But the military, which has its own targeted killing program and also does signature strikes, he said, I'm going to draw the line there. First of all, I'm going to make sure that I sign off on every single targeted killing that the military conducts in places like Yemen and Somalia, and I'm not going to allow signature strikes. And he did that for quite some time. He did really over the last few months relent to some extent on signature strikes in Yemen, for example.
How significant is that the president himself would be involved in making that call? Is that unprecedented?
Well, I think it is unprecedented for a program. First of all, we didn't have the capacity to kill people in remote places from great distances like we did before.
Sure.
So you know, there's not a lot of history here, but you know, presidents really rarely, if ever, making individual targeting decisions. Very rare circumstances. I think that President Roosevelt actually made one decision during World War II, going after the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack. President Bush, who also had this drone program at his disposal, did not make these individual targeting decisions. He was the CEO president, famously, and he delegated. I think President Obama did this for a couple of reasons. One, I think he did understand that there was some moral distinction to be made between kind of conventional warfare, where you are bombing targets, and making decisions where you actually know the names and the addresses of the people that you're deciding to kill. And so he wanted to assume the moral responsibility for those decisions. But I think in some ways the overriding reason was that this was a president who came in with very little national security experience, no military experience at all. And I think he was wary of the military.
Yeah.
He wanted to make sure that he was exercising some restraints over the military. He was concerned, for example, about the danger of mission creep, or what he sometimes called requirement creep, that you go into some of these places if you're not very careful, you can find yourself sucked into conflicts there. He wanted to limit the war on terror. He was not in favor of a global war on terror. I think he understood that you needed real civilian oversight of military force, and he wanted to do it himself.
You of course, what's remarkable about your book is the extensive reporting that you've done, access that you've had to administration officials, many of them, of course, speaking on the condition of anonymity. And what interests me, I think, on some levels, are just some of the particulars of some of the stories. One, for example, you write about these kill meetings that go on. And oftentimes you say that it's John Brennan, Haas Cartwright, and Barack Obama making the call. Talk about how it plays out. What did you learn about how these meetings play out?
Yeah, this was one of the most fascinating parts of the reporting for me. When I began this project, I had no idea how these decisions were made. Now, this is in the context of the military's targeted killing program.
Right.
And what happens essentially is the military nominates a target. That's their word, nominate. They've developed what they dryly call baseball cards, which are, in essence, PowerPoint slides that have a picture of the target and then all sorts of biographical information, who the person is, where he ranks in the organization, Al-Qaeda, let's say, what operations he's been involved in. And then there is a fair amount of supporting intelligence so that people can assess the quality of the intelligence and you know why they actually believe that this person is dangerous and should be targeted for death. Those baseball cards, which are highly classified, get sent out to a number of different agencies. The CIA, the Defense Department originates it, the White House, the National Security Council, and the State Department. And after people have had a chance, sometimes as little as half an hour or 45 minutes, to look at these baseball cards, because there's sometimes a very narrow window of opportunity, they assemble on a video teleconference called a CIVETS.
Right.
And there can be as many as 75 to 100 officials from across the national security bureaucracy. And they essentially debate whether and how and whether it is legal and sometimes moral to go after these targets. It's a pretty impressive vetting process. And there is, you know, a fair amount of debate on the one hand. On the other hand, the military, you know, in these settings, they have more people. They can be pretty intimidating with their jargon, with their command of the intelligence and the ordnance and the technology. So if you're somebody who does not have that background and you're sitting in on these meetings, it can be a little intimidating. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there really is a lot of debate about these issues. And then eventually, assuming everyone or most people sign on to a targeted killing, in every instance, literally every instance, it then goes to the president.
Yeah.
And John Brennan, president's chief counterterrorism advisor, and Haas Cartwright, during most of his presidency — Haas Cartwright was the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and had a very good relationship with President Obama — they would take the recommendation to the president, sometimes in the Oval Office, sometimes if it was a very urgent operation, they'd pull him out of a state dinner or dinner with the president's daughters, and he'd have to make these very grim calls. But in every case, he made them.
Do you know not just what the criteria is for getting on one of these lists, but is part of the conversation, what is the acceptable rate of you know, collateral damage, you know, civilians? I mean, I think you say that the casualty rate is something like 17% for these drone strikes. Put that in perspective and talk about, is that part of the conversation in these meetings?
Absolutely. The president really did have very strict guidelines about collateral damage, which is the military's awful term for civilian deaths or the deaths of non-combatants. The rule essentially was if there was a significant chance of civilians being killed, the operation would not be authorized. Mm-hmm. Mostly when civilians are killed, it's not because the military or the CIA knows that there are non-combatants in the area and that they might die. It's because they've made mistakes. It's because the intelligence that they've relied on is not as accurate as it should be. It's because of some technological error, not because the military or the CIA or the president himself has decided, well, let's just take the chance here, or frankly, the target is so dangerous, it's so important that we get this particular person that it's worth some number of civilians dying. That's not the way it works. There are exceedingly rare instances in which that was the case, in which the president, on at least one occasion that I write about, said to his advisors, look, don't foreclose my options here. Because generally speaking, Haas Cartwright or John Brennan wouldn't even bring a recommendation to the president if they knew there was a significant chance that civilians would die. Hmm. In one case, the president said, don't foreclose my options. I want to make this decision. He was willing to consider the possibility of collateral damage, but that was extremely rare.
Do you are the terms important as to what we call it? The idea it's a targeted killing, or you know, the term assassination comes up. Do you ever hear that term in the context of
this? It's interesting because early on in my reporting, when I was talking to people in the military and in other agencies, I would talk about assassinations, and particularly when you talk to lawyers, and lawyers are deeply involved in these decisions. They're almost offended. They'll cut you off and they'll say these are not assassinations. And there's this distinction that they make, which I think is an important one, though it's lost on a lot of people, and maybe it does sound, you know, kind of very lawyerly. But assassinations, first of all, are illegal. There is an executive order dating back to the Ford administration. Assassinations are essentially political killings when the decision is made to go after a political target, often civilians. Targeted killings, which, you know, sounds like one of those terrible euphemisms. I think the Israelis used that term back when they were doing these kinds of operations and we were condemning them back when I was a correspondent in Israel. The distinction that lawyers make is that these targeted killings are lawful acts of war. They are going after individuals who present a serious and imminent threat to the security of the United States. Now, all of that can be debated as well. What does imminent mean? Some people say that the administration has redefined the word imminent to be almost meaningless. But in any event, they consider these to be lawful acts of war and therefore legal under domestic law, legal under international law as well. And so they do bridle when the word assassination is used. In some respects, you know, in the business of war, there have always been these kinds of euphemisms because what these people are involved in is killing. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, I didn't come across anybody in my reporting that I thought was bloodthirsty and enjoyed killing. And so there is a kind of a natural human process. It's easier to use some of these terms when you're involved in these kinds of activities, which can be very difficult.
You talk about the way the president his thinking on these drone strikes, how it has evolved. And you've talked about it not being a straight line. You say that the president realized that, look, if we're going to fight this war, that Americans don't have much taste for sending troops or occupying foreign lands anymore. So we're going to have to really go about it in a different way. And so he seemed to sign on to it and sees, you know, figured it made sense in some ways. But I think you talk about how he never really has seemed entirely settled on it. He sort of goes back and forth, realizes it's important, but still has his doubts. Do you think that's the way to describe it now?
I think it is. I think in some ways it's commendable. It is someone who wrestled with the morality of these kinds of activities. He did sign on to it early on. One of his closest advisors told me that he never fully got comfortable with signature strikes. Mm-hmm. He never got comfortable with the idea that we could fire a missile at a group of men who bear certain characteristics associated with terrorism, but where we don't know for a fact that they're terrorists. And as this person put it, he would squirm in his seat. And I think at a kind of a highly rational level, he understood that this was something that he wanted or needed to approve for the CIA. But maybe he, acting out the other part of his conscience, he said the military couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times when, many times, when the military would come to him with a proposed strike going after a significant number of individuals, say in Yemen or in another case in Somalia, and the president said no.
Yeah.
He either vetoed the operation or scaled back the number of people who could be targeted. That's because he was very concerned that in a place like Yemen, for example, it's sometimes difficult to differentiate between those parts of the al-Qaeda organization there who were wanted to attack America and who represented demonstrable threats against the United States and the American people, and those elements of the organization that were primarily involved in a local civil war.
Mm.
And he wanted to be as careful as possible because his fear was that the more attacks they did in Yemen the more kind of haphazard the attacking was, the more likely that we would find ourselves, sort of sucked into the local civil war or insurgency there. And this was a president who was elected on a promise to, at least in a part, on a promise to wind down the wars of 9/11. He was going to pull the troops out of Iraq, and he was going to win decisively in Afghanistan, but ultimately pull the troops out of Afghanistan. He didn't particularly want to continue, opening up fronts all over. But there were other occasions where the president was willing to, in the words of the military, widen the aperture,
yeah.
where the recommendation was to go after a small group of people and then they might have an opportunity to go after someone else, and the president would say, okay, if we think we can do it, let's do it. He was kind of a supple decision maker, although I will say that more often than not, I think his tendency was to scale back the numbers rather than to widen or increase the numbers of people who were being targeted.
You've talked a little bit about the question that often comes up when you're talking about drone strikes, and that is whether or not the idea of, basically killing people from a cubicle, thousands of miles away, whether or not that will, I think this is how you've put it, dull our moral sensibilities. I'm wondering, does the president think about that at all, do you think?
It's a good question. It's not something that I encountered in my reporting. I can't imagine that he did not think about that. That's a point that, a lot of people have made. I think that when President Obama thinks about drone strikes, my sense is, and people have told me this, he doesn't think about them in a vacuum. He thinks about them in the context of all of the other options. And for him, it was not an option to simply allow people in northern or southern Waziristan to continue to train and plot to attack America. And so the question was then, well, what do you do about it? You can rely on the Pakistanis. Which has not been particularly effective. You can do other kinds of airstrikes. You can try to go in on the ground. Of course, Pakistan was off limits to American troops. But all of those other options likely would lead to both more civilian deaths and just as much, if not more, blowback from the local populations there. So I think the way the president thought about it was, well, if not these kinds of operations, which may not be perfect, but are some considerably more precise and targeted than other options. It's the worst. It's the best of all of the evils.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
So he went with that.
You've said that look for to the critics of these drone programs. Look, they're here to stay. And the thing you ought to be really focusing on, those who are critics of this, is not just the drone program themselves, but the transparency in the program. That's the thing you've said that they should be focusing on, really.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's healthy in a democracy for there to be an enormous amount of debate and discussion and reporting about these kinds of programs. People find drones very disturbing. I think it is, in some ways, what you alluded to before, this idea of, you're killing from a distance. We don't have as much skin in the game when you're firing missiles from a cubicle, in Langley, Virginia, or some Air Force base in Nevada. In a sense, that makes killing easier.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, any president, I think, who's faced with these kinds of threats, if the choice is to send in American troops, put many more Americans at risk at a much greater cost financially, they're going to avail themselves of this opportunity. So I think in some form, in some instances, drones are here to stay. And I think what is essential is that people put pressure on the government to explain its procedures, how they vet these operations, to what extent they follow the laws of war. How are drone operators trained in the laws of war? What kind of accountability is there when things go awry? I mean, if you think about it, when a military aircraft, a bomber, bombs. Some wedding party by accident when they think they're going after a terrorist compound and dozens of innocent civilians are killed, there are investigations. We learn about it. There's accountability. Sometimes people are court-martialed. When a CIA drone operator makes a similar kind of mistake because they perhaps were not following the rules or for whatever reason, we never hear about any of that. And so it's hard to know whether the CIA has the kind of accountability mechanisms that the military has. And I think that is important for people to know. And I think that's where much of the criticism ought to be.
Daniel Kleidman is with us. He's author of the book Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the question of how you balance liberty with national security while you fight a war on terror. Our guest is the journalist Daniel Kleidman. He's written a book that takes a behind-the-scenes look at the way the Obama administration has managed that question. The book is about how the realities of the presidency and the threat of terror have transformed Barack Obama's ideas and his approach. The book is called Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And Daniel Kleidman is joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. So I want to ask you about this story that you used to set the book up. It's January of 2010, and President Obama and his top advisors, they've gathered at the White House, and they're talking about the administration's plan. You know, they want to try the 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in federal court in Manhattan. And it's an important symbolic thing for the president, you write about, but there's some fierce opposition. Criticism is growing, and Mayor Bloomberg has now come on as being opposed to it. And what's interesting about the story you talk about is this is where we get the sense of the split that's going on, this internal war, as you describe it, in the Obama administration between, I guess, between what – there's always a clash, I guess, between the realists and the idealists. But talk about that, how that that dynamic plays out within the Obama White House.
Well, as you say, every administration I've ever covered, I think every administration going back to the beginning has been characterized by splits between those people who are more idealistic and those who are more pragmatic or political, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I think what tends to happen is those positions over time can harden a bit you know, you're always going to have people who are in outside agencies, in this case the Justice Department, who feel that it's their responsibility to push the policies that were promised during the administration and do the right thing, and people in the White House who see a much bigger picture because they're responsible for pushing through the president's entire agenda and can't just focus on one aspect of it. And so that is a natural, inevitable, and I think healthy clash in all administrations. It played out in a very intense way on these issues of security and liberty and counterterrorism policy. When President Obama took office, he had inherited a country that was still in economic freefall. I mean, you have to remember that in those first few months, the possibility of the country sinking into depression was still a real possibility.
Yeah.
And the president and his advisors, I think, made some hard choices fairly early on that their principal focus was going to be on the economy, getting a stimulus bill passed. And then later they made a decision, which was also in part an economic decision, to pursue health care reform. In the first 3 months of the administration, 3 or 4 months of the administration, what the White House found out was that these terrorism issues were far more toxic than they had ever anticipated. I think in some sense, when President Obama signed on his second day in office a series of executive orders closing the ending coercive interrogation techniques closing the CIA's black sites, overseas secret prisons, and calling for the closure of Guantanamo in 1 year, there might have been a sort of a false sense of optimism that these things could be done just with the stroke of a pen. As the administration tried to push some of these other issues in dealing with Guantanamo, for example, they wanted to bring in a small number of detainees into the United States to make it easier for other countries to take detainees themselves. There was a huge rebellion in Congress, not just from Republicans, by the way, but from within the president's own party. And the White House was very spooked by the reaction in Congress and the fact that these issues were still so politically toxic. They began to fear that they would not be able to push through other elements of the president's agenda, which frankly were their priorities.
Yeah.
And so it plays out in the first year on the issue of detainees, but also civilian versus military trials. And Eric Holder, the attorney general, who was a close friend of the president's and I put in the idealist camp, yeah, makes this decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in civilian court in New York. There's a huge, very negative reaction to it in Congress and around the country at large. And so the administration and the president is really put to a test here as to whether he's going to stick to his ideals. He had promised that terrorists would be tried in civilian courts. And the question was he going to back down? He was under enormous pressure from both sides of his administration, from the idealists and the pragmatists. And this meeting that I write about in January of 2010 is after the rebellion against the decision. How are they going to move forward? What were they going to do? And what's fascinating about that particular meeting is that the sort of two sides of Obama is playing out in front of everybody. He's clearly deeply conflicted. He knows what he thinks the right thing to do, and he has to reconcile that with you know, the very brutal and difficult political environment in which he's operating. And so you see those two sides of Barack Obama in this one meeting.
And there's this remarkable moment where the president reads to the people in the meeting this this statement, this kind of speech that was given by U.S. District Judge William Young. And Young had just sentenced Richard Reed, the so-called shoe bomber, to these multiple life sentences. And then he gave this speech. And the president, I guess, Daniel Kleidman, he read the whole thing to the group?
He read the entire thing. This was a sentencing statement that Judge Young issued all the way back in 2003, I believe it was, when the shoe bomber was convicted of trying to bring down an airliner from London. The basic point of Judge Young's speech, I think the shoe bomber, Reed, had referred to himself as a warrior. Yeah. And Judge Young wanted to make the point that he was not a warrior. He was a common criminal. Not a common criminal necessarily, but he was a criminal with blood on his hands. And that the point that Judge Young, I think, tried to make in that speech was that we will show you how strong we are by giving you all of the rights that we afford to anybody who comes into an American courtroom. We'll show you how resilient we are in terms of our values and our adherence to constitutional principles. We're going to treat you like the criminal that you are, not like some kind of holy warrior that you want to be. And that was it was quite a long sentencing statement. It must have taken the president a good 3 minutes to read this to the assembled group. This was his national security cabinet, essentially. At the end of it, the president looked up, not really looking at anyone in particular, and he said, "Why can't I give that speech?" And he stood up and he walked out of the room, leaving that question hanging in the air. It's quite a remarkable moment, a very pregnant question. And in a lot of ways, my book really is an attempt to answer that question.
Yeah.
Why couldn't Barack Obama give that speech? Many people will say he could have and he should have. Other people will argue that our politics are so toxic on these issues, so difficult, that if he had given that speech, he would have suffered in many other ways.
Mm. You know, that balance that is throughout the book. I mean, it's a really important part of the book. And you talk about this conversation he has with Richard Clark, which is really interesting. The conversation they have, because on one hand, Clark reports that that the president didn't seem to flinch from the idea that this is, you know, this is tough. He said to the president, you know, as president, you kill people. And the president said, you know, I understand that. But then there's this other part of him that Richard Clark talks to you about, which is that, you know, a man who had a broader view of the world, who had seen poverty in his travels, had seen repression. Clark read it as you put it in the book, an intuitive understanding of these forces that drive extremism. So there are the two parts of him. He understands that it's that you do have to kill people, but then on the other hand, he understands that there's nuance to it. And what's interesting about the book is that he wants Clark to help him weave those two ideas together. And I guess the question is, how does he go about that, and is it really possible to weave those two ideas together?
Well, you know, I think in some ways history will have to judge President Obama as to whether he's been able to weave those two things together. there's no question that that's what he's tried to do. I don't have any doubt. I don't think that this is a president who came into the office suddenly realized these issues are so difficult. You know, I've got a war to fight. I'm just going to sell my values down the river start ramping up drone strikes. I think he was always a pretty pragmatic guy. You know, when he opposed the Iraq War, for example, which was really his kind of political coming out when he gave that speech in Chicago, he didn't say, I oppose all wars. He said, I oppose dumb wars. When he was given the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010 and gave his speech accepting the prize, it was essentially a speech in support of the just war.
Yeah.
So he was never a pacifist, and he was never a pure idealist. He was always a complicated character. All presidents, I think, at some level, would like to be known as idealists, realists, or realists who are idealistic. That's, I think, what he was striving for. And if you take the efforts that he made to roll back the excesses of the previous administration, many of which have not succeeded,
yeah.
But there's no question that he is struggling and trying to do some of these things. You know, you take that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the fact that he is, continuing to fight this war in a very lethal way, but in his mind, in a much more precise and targeted way, which I think he views as more humanitarian at some levels. I think, I think he would reject as false this kind of dichotomy between a pure idealist and a pure pragmatist.
Daniel Kleidman is with us. His book is Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. We need to take another brief break, so we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Daniel Kleidman. We're talking about his new book, Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. 801-585-WEST, by the way, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You know, on some level, Daniel Kleidman, you get the sense that the story is about a kind of, maybe this is an overwrought way of putting it, but this kind of losing your innocence when you learn about the reality. And not only is it the evolution of Barack Obama, but I think it's really interesting the evolution of a man named Harold Koh, who's this advisor to the president, former dean of the Yale Law School. And, he has these moments where he sees the awful realities, I guess, about some of the people that they're talking about in the abstract. And his evolution is really interesting, and I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, Harold Koh is a fascinating character. As you said, he was the former dean of the Law School. He was a revered, maybe the most revered human rights lawyer of his generation. During the Clinton administration, he served as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, in which he spent much of his time focusing on preventing or holding people accountable for war crimes or genocide. He comes back into the government in 2009. All of a sudden, he's very involved in advising the president and the military on targeted killings.
Yeah.
And the State Department lawyer plays a role in these kill meetings that we talked about earlier on the show, where they're making these decisions on who can be killed and who should be spared. Part of it is that Harold Koh, I think, saw himself as the sort of protector of the rule of law and the person who was going to make sure that whatever military action we take was consistent with human rights and international law. So he sort of aggressively inserted himself into these meetings. He might have been there, or the whoever had his job might have been there anyway, but Harold Coe is a pugnacious guy with strong convictions, and he wanted to be very involved in the process. What he found attending these meetings was that, you know, it was very difficult in some ways to resist the momentum toward more killing. He didn't know all of the jargon. He didn't understand the references to all of the military technology and the ordnance they were using, and that there was this kind of inexorable momentum toward using more force that he found a hard time to resist it at first. And then there was his own, you know, he couldn't believe that here he was someone, you know, a law professor who suddenly was involved in killing. And that took a real adjustment for him to kind of come to terms with that. Once he did, he realized that what he needed to do was to really study all of these issues, the legal issues, the intelligence. He needed to understand who exactly was being placed on these kill lists and know as much about them as possible ahead of time so that he could make cogent arguments as to whether they whether they would be lawful killings or not. But he's also going through his own personal transformation in the sense that, you know, he begins to understand that a lot of these people do represent serious threats to the safety of the American people, and that you simply couldn't throw law and process in the way of every single operation because there were national security imperatives that they had to take seriously.
There's this. There are a couple of stories that stand out for Harold Coe. I mean, you know, he has his qualms about all of this, but there was one particular story about Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen and the radical cleric who was killed in this drone attack in Yemen. American citizen is the crucial point there, and Coe has his problems with it. But you talk about that he went to read the documents, the classified documents, and you have to go into this space to read them into this room, and it really transformed his thinking on it.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of things here. One is because he's one is that the administration very much partly because of Anwar al-Awlaki, it had leaked that al-Awlaki, an American citizen, as you pointed out, was put on the kill list. They realized that they were going to have to get out there and speak publicly about targeted killings and to make sure that the public understood that there was a lawful justification for these acts. And they thought that White House thought that Harold Coe would be a very good messenger for them because of his credibility within the human rights community. But Harold Coe didn't want to simply be used by the administration. He wanted to make sure that if he was going to go out there and defend targeted killings, that they could be defended, both as a matter of law, policy, and morality. Secondly, Harold Coe's, I think, concern about targeting Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen, was that he was you know, not going to have the kind of he saw a distinction between killing an American citizen and killing a non-citizens, even in the context of war. And I think he, to some degree, believed that Anwar al-Awlaki was due more process, due process, than a foreigner would. And so I think at some level he believed that it was up to him to provide that kind of process, which is to say to take to study the intelligence as closely as possible, to make sure that that the threats were real, to make sure that they lined up with the legal standards. In other words, that he was a demonstrable threat to American national security, that the threat was imminent, so on and so forth. And so he essentially locked himself in the State Department's you know, secret room where they read classified information, and for 4-5 hours read all of the intelligence on al-Awlaki. He was only planning on being there for an hour or so, but he kept canceling meetings because there was so much information and he found himself so kind of mesmerized by what he was reading. At the end of it, he came up with his own sort of not very scientific legal standard, but he said, you know, this guy is essentially evil. Yeah. He's satanic was the word he used, and persuaded himself that it was justified to target him. And, you know, spending 5 hours in that room reading about all of these potential threats and diabolical plans that Anwar al-Awlaki was said to have been involved in, I think was a significant part of Harold Coe's transformation from the liberal idealist to much more of a kind of a pragmatic figure in the administration.
Let me ask you this finally. So you write extensively about these two tensions going on within the Obama administration, the so-called pragmatists against the so-called idealists, and as Rahm Emanuel called them, Tammany Hall versus the Aspen Institute. And I guess the question is, who's holding sway these days? Do you have a sense of it?
Oh, I think that Tammany Hall has held sway really since 2010. Yeah. Ultimately, there are individual cases where the Aspen Institute, the liberal idealists may win over. But for the most part, look, this is a president who has not suffered politically one bit, really, by pursuing the policies he's pursued. Perhaps among his most hardcore liberal base, but as a political matter, he's polling extremely high in this area, and he's very unlikely, I think, to move back in the other direction. Possibly in a second term, we'll see.
Daniel Kleidman. His book is called Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. Joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Daniel Kleidman, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Thanks to Tim Slover. Radio West produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.